As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to The View from the Lane, the multi-award-winning Tottenham Hotspur podcast from The Athletic. I'm Danny Kelly, your host, complete with actual internet, having been forced to miss the game. Someone rightly said it's like pulling up in the warm-up with a calf injury. And joining me today, and they held the fort brilliantly during my absence, The Athletic's James Moore and Charlie Eccleshare. Hello to you two. On today's episode, we'll discuss... cue doomy music. The lack of intensity in that defeat to Fulham, whether this was a blip or a performance that's perhaps Spurs returning to the mean, perhaps they had coming, and an Ange Postecoglou and fans' reaction to the defeat. So the scoreline is pretty stark, pretty naked, pretty plain. Fulham 3, Tottenham Hotspur 0. Charlie, you were at Craven Cottage, and in your piece in The Athletic, which I think went up even as we speak almost this morning, you're asking the question how Spurs went from their best performance of the season, certainly in terms of the result at Aston Villa, to arguably their worst performance of the season at Craven Cottage. Can you explain why, Charlie?
I think it was their worst, given the strength of their lineup. You know, there was no kind of injury crisis or...
The bench was packed as well, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, missing Van de Ven, which is a big loss... But I think in that context, it was the worst. I mean, joint biggest margin with Chelsea, but obviously Chelsea was such a mad game. I think Van de Ven is a big miss. I tweeted saying I thought it was another game that reminded us that he's kind of the one player Spurs struggled most without. And I think some agreed with that. Some felt that, well, you know, everyone was bad. It's not just about Van de Ven's absence, which wasn't really what I was saying. I just think that is a big drop off. And also, you know, Dragushin... It was his first Premier League start, and it was a tough game to come into. And he did okay in part, but he was caught out for two of the goals. Could arguably say three. Spurs missed a lot of chances as well. It was their third highest XG figure of the season. And certainly in the first half, I think the first goal was always going to be key. And they had those Madison, Son, Johnson all had chances they didn't take. But the big thing... and Son alluded to this afterwards, just the lack of intensity. You know, he said the attitude wasn't there, and it did feel like that. I mean, watching it, and this is sort of unquantifiable, and who knows, but it did feel, and I know others have touched on this, it did feel a little complacent. It did feel a little bit like they were listening to the podcasts and reading the article, all the hype around them and all the praise. And
well, I hope they're listening today.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah, it will really help.
To be clear, I'm not actually suggesting they listen to this. But yeah, they just did. They weren't really at it, I guess. They didn't compete. I thought Fulham were really good. I was really impressed with them. And they basically honed in on the fact that Spurs pushed their fullbacks inside and or high. And their whole game plan was about creating overloads out wide. And from as early as the second minute, they got a good chance by doing that. And they just kept doing it throughout the first half and into the second.
Marco Silva... I think he's a really good football coach. He hasn't always had the best material to work with. He's got some very good players at Fulham, by the way. But Marco Silva, if nothing else, and look, I've been thinking about this a lot overnight. He prepared Fulham in a way where if it went their way, they had the exact right tools for the job. By which I mean, if someone you're very hungry and someone gives you a tin of beans and they give you a hammer to open it with, that way, that's no use to you, really. You need a tin opener. And so Marco Silva prepared them with the tin opener. Simple as this. Go back and watch the game again, listeners, if you can be bothered. I mean, I wouldn't blame you if you couldn't be bothered. Where Spurs have gaps, i.e. when they're playing averagely in midfield or they lose the ball in midfield, that big circle in front of the back four and behind the back four, there wasn't a single time when the ball was turned over where they didn't put either the ball or a player. They didn't allow Spurs to de-stress. They put the players or the ball. Sometimes the player ran into the space and didn't get the ball. Sometimes the ball went there and there was no player. But they always put one of those two things into the place where the Spurs defence would want it least. And you're right, Charlie. Spurs had three decent chances. But anybody who comes back to you with the XG or the fact that they had as nearly as many shots at goal eventually as Fulham, it's nonsense. The eye test was that Spurs were under pressure almost throughout the game. They had 15 minutes before half-time before the Fulham goal where they weren't. But it was very, very good by Fulham's coach. But Spurs are allowed to react to that, and they didn't. Now, James, what did you make of the game overall?
I mean, I'd say that's a pretty fair assessment, that it was clear, I would say, from the first 5-10 tops minutes that was what Fulham were going to do and that it was going to be a problem for Spurs. That certainly wouldn't have been the first game where we would have said that was the case. But I think you said at the start of the show, you questioned whether this was something that had been coming. And I would say perhaps yes, in as much as Spurs didn't really play well in the first half, didn't create a whole lot, largely restricted the opposition, were pretty resolute defensively. Not good, but sort of good enough. I know they did go 1-0 down. But it wasn't a million miles away from the first half of Palace, Brentford, Brighton, whatever. The home game against Brighton, I should say. But obviously the difference here was it didn't miraculously just change in the second half as it has done in those other games. There was no, or certainly not until the substitutions, there was no suggestion that anything was going to change. And if anything, I mean, that 15, 20 minutes immediately after half time is probably the worst bit of the game in terms of like having any kind of a foothold. We've talked about this system a million and one times being risk and reward. And that probably has been encapsulated by the last two performances against a team who have a tactical plan that involves pushing defenders up the pitch and leaving that space and taking risks themselves. And there is an opportunity for Spurs to win a game and to win quite handsomely. But against a team who are defending maybe slightly more, I keep using the word conventionally, but I mean, I guess I really mean like a lower block, and look to exploit those weaknesses, as you mentioned, out wide, but either side of the centre-backs consistently. And like, as you say, that's what they did for the whole game. I mean, I'd love to see the number of crosses played into the box.
Low crosses. They just kept doing the same thing.
Two of the goals, I guess, were like that, weren't they? And I look, I mean, Spurs have scored loads of goals like that, obviously. It's been a thing that they've looked to do as well, but it's clearly a big weakness. And I was disappointed that it didn't really seem to be there was no reaction to that at all. And I mean, I think some managers have reacted to that within the first 20 minutes of the game. And Postecoglou didn't even react to it at half-time when it felt like you've gone in at half-time, you've had a bit of a shellacking in the first half in terms of kind of being penned in, you've not been able to create too much. Although Maddison had that shot just wide, Johnson had a chance, but there wasn't a whole lot in it. And I don't know, it felt like that was the opportunity to change it. But for whatever reason, I don't know if it was just this assumption that they'd come back in so many games before in the last couple of months. They're a second-half team. They play better in second-half so often that maybe there was a bit of complacency among players and coaching staff that it would just kind of work itself out if they just kind of butt their ideas up or whatever. And they didn't change anything. They didn't change anything at all tactically in terms of personnel until it was 3-0 and they were out of the game.
And just numbers, what? It's now five first halves in a row Spurs haven't scored. You've got to go back to the Everton game, the away game for their last first half goal. But yeah, and James, on that point of the not change after half time, I mean, I I was doing something for the kind of instant piece after the game on how they kept getting exposed down the flanks. So I was keeping a close eye on it after, because I'd done a chunk at half time, and then literally 46th minute, the same thing happened again. And then a few minutes after that, it happened again for what was the second goal. I mean, it was one of those, like, it was the definition of it had been coming. Just they kept not heeding the warnings. I guess, you know, with the changes and all of that, you trust, or the manager trusts, that, you know, this is a system that will work over the course of the game. Obviously, in this instance, it didn't. But I can see why it's really frustrating when a warning just isn't really being heeded.
I understand why you would persist with that over the course of a season or longer, even within games when things aren't going your way. But in those circumstances where it so obviously is the thing that's being exploited, it's cost you one goal, actually two goals within, 47, 48, 50 minutes or whatever it was. Like, why you then don't, like, make the change at least at 2-0 and say, look, we're going to defend with a more orthodox back four, then we're going to try and progress the ball up the pitch, and then we're going to hope we have the quality to get one goal back. And we all know if it goes 2-1, then the game is completely different, and then mentality is completely changing. Spurs' tails are up, and Fulham, although they're a very good defensive team with a very good defensive record, they would start to panic at least a little bit. And it completely changes the dynamic of the game and the sense in the crowd and whatever else. And they didn't give themselves the opportunity to do that because they waited until it was 3/4-0 before they changed anything. And that is, I find that really disappointing. And look, we talk so much about that Chelsea game and how it was right in that instance to just leave it as it was. But I just don't see that in every single circumstance you can just persist with it like this. It seems bizarre to me that, I mean, look, and I know Ange Postecoglou will say he's looking at the bigger picture than this season, which is absolutely fine. And it's good that he does that, and it's right that he does that. But you do have to balance the short term, the immediate goals, aims, possible successes of the team, the club in this season, with the longer term picture as well. That's what every other manager is basically doing. Like, it's not impossible to balance those two things.
It's not. And look, just to give an example of what people were trying to say to us, Coy's Casey on Twitter said, can we not overreact? Is that possible? Are we capable of recognising that sometimes bad days at the office in the most competitive league in the world inevitably are going to happen? Casey, that's fine. But when we're all purring after the Aston Villa game, we buy the right to say what we want to say.
But it's fine to have a bad day at the office as long as you learn from that. That's absolutely fine. But this has happened a couple of times, though. This happened away at Brighton as well.
Am I right in saying, Charlie, you usually have this, that over some extended period of time now, so not just overreacting to this game, has Spurs got the second worst defensive record since January the 1st, except for Sheffield United?
It's not quite that. It's not far off it. It's basically the number of clean sheets that have been kept. They've kept two clean sheets, Spurs, in their last 19 Premier League games, which is, that's basically half a season. Only Sheffield United have kept fewer in that.
That's
period.
Terrible.
So it's not quite, yeah. It's by any match, that's really bad.
That is fixable without throwing away all your principles, I think. But
yeah, I think, to be fair to Casey, I mean, I guess the argument would be as well, did we overreact after Villa? And is then this an overreaction? You know, if you zoom out, Is it to say that, you know, one wasn't so bad, one wasn't so good? I don't know. I mean, I think Villa was really good, and I think it's right that it was described in that way.
It was also a very important result. It's better that they thrashed Villa and got thrashed by Fulham than if they got thrashed by Villa and then went to Craven Cottage and won 4-0. I mean, obviously that's better for the overall aims of the season.
It is difficult, though, because, as James says, it is about balancing short-term and long-term, and I think most people are able to zoom out and say the direction of travel is really positive, but it's still hard not to be disappointed when you have results like this and feel that it was a bad performance, and that I think because there were so many individual performances that felt so way off the level that we've come to expect. But it's also fine to ignore. You know, I think Fulham away is a harder game maybe than collectively we sort of appreciated, expected. I think there is...
It doesn't matter what we expect. It's the players who went to Fulham and played like that.
But I do think the fact that And this sounds silly, but I really do believe it. The fact that Fulham is West London, it's a nice, cuddly, cozy ground, makes people think of it as not a hard place to go. Like, if Fulham played in the north of England, I think we would have been saying, oh, tough place to go, Fulham. Like, oh, you don't want to go there. I do think it informs people's view of this sort of thing. It's like people still saying, like, oh, Sheffield United, tough place to go. It's absolutely not. They're rubbish. But Fulham are good at home. They've had some really good results at home. And maybe there was an element, certainly those looking from the outside, and you don't know about internally, but the way Son was speaking, he definitely gave the impression that, you know, he felt that collectively there was an underestimation of Fulham and how hard this game would be.
How can I say this without getting into trouble for not being a fully paid up member of any cult ever, which I am not? Maybe the cult Captain Beefheart, possibly. Things aren't permanent. They aren't electable. They are changeable. They are reactable to watching Spurs being so easy to get at. And of course, you know, they don't always do that. They don't, it's not, but it's often the case. And Fulham was an absolute classic example. It does frustrate me. I'm not going to pretend otherwise. I mean, you've come on to the next issue here. And we're going at these things higgledy-piggledy because I think it's actually like whack-a-mole. There were so many things wrong at Craven Cottage that it's very hard to just say, right, we're going to discuss that. But
that is the thing, though. For a good team to lose a game 3-0 and play that badly, you need it is almost like the perfect storm. You do need, like, 4, 5, 6 different circumstances to align for that to happen. So we can talk about the tactics, and that's maybe you call that one or two elements of it. But also, like, individual performances, not just from players who we might consider to be a bit up and down, but from players who I think for this season have been really consistent. And I'm not suggesting there's no mitigation in any individual circumstances, because, you know, for someone like Pedro Porro, who's just come back from an injury and probably isn't quite fully sharp, but like Porro, who's been the most consistent player in the team this season, probably you could argue the best player in the team this season, was pretty bad, I thought. Pap Sarr, who we've talked about a lot recently as being one of the more important players in the team, having like the qualities that make this team function at its best. I thought a lot of his passing was really, really off, like at a far lower standard than usual. He didn't look right at all. Son, who historically we've talked about as a player who's been a bit streaky, but I think this season his contribution has been far more consistent when he's been in the team. Like, I think he's probably had a goal or assist more or less every single game. I do think when he plays in that role up front through the middle, if a team isn't playing well, he really struggles to affect the game. And I think that was fairly obvious from the game on Saturday. And again, when he had the ball, he didn't do much with it. It wasn't great. And then once you factor that in with the players who I think we think are a bit up and down, you know, players like
Bissouma,
Kulusevski, who is obviously a brilliant player, but occasionally does have games where he can't really affect the game. Who else have we got? Udogi, I think. Udogi we all think of as a brilliant player, but I think we all know occasionally there are like defensive lapses, but he's learning that position, learning that role. You know, there's a very high ceiling there, fine. Bissouma, you just mentioned, I think he's probably the player who kind of splits opinions the most out of the current team, it seems to me. I thought he played well against Palace and very well against Villa and was kind of hopeful that we were going to get back to seeing the kind of Bissouma from the first 10, 12 weeks of the season and previously at Brighton. But yeah, again, a really bad performance from him as well. So, and then the obvious subconscious thing of the defence. I mean, I could be interested to get your opinion on this, Charlie, because you're in the ground. But it did seem to me like the defensive line was just that little bit deeper, because I don't think this was an instruction from Postecoglou. I guarantee it wasn't. But I just think subconsciously they just like held a slightly lower line because they were worried about Dragosin's recovery pace, which kind of makes sense. But I think that's why not only was there this massive space, or these massive spaces either side of the centre backs, which Fulham exploited so much, but there was also this massive space in front of them as well. Just a massive space for Fulham to play in.
No, totally. I think that's just another reason why Van de Ven's absence is so keenly felt, and why when I said that, some people took it as like a dig at Dragosin. It wasn't. It's just no one is as quick as him. He's absolute lightning, and he's so confident. I mean, like you saw it, and he showed it against Ollie Watkins the previous week. He does allow Spurs to play in that really different way. It makes a huge difference. I mean, I think the whole thing with this, and I this seems to be the debate, is, you know, the best managers, look at Guardiola, Klopp, they don't compromise hugely, but maybe they make little tweaks. And I guess it just comes down, and, you know, part of the reason why they've built these brilliant teams is because they haven't compromised. They've accepted these bumps in the road. And so, you know, I do kind of think we need to accept that if we believe that Postecoglou is the right man. Then it just comes down to the extent to which you think, yes, Klopp and Guardiola don't abandon their principles, but they do make little tweaks. And it's hard to know the extent to which that's true relative to Postecoglou. But that broadly seems to be what most Spurs fans want. It's like, yeah, absolutely believe in your principles, but do make these little tweaks. And I think he would argue it's a slippery slope. And once you start making these compromises, these sacrifices, the clarity of the message dilutes. I mean, he was very sanguine after the game. I would say that he wasn't, you know, his mood was very different to Son's mood. Son was obviously, it was a very emotional response, and he was clearly really upset and really angry. I think Postecoglou was coming at it more from the point of, there are going to be days like this from time to time. And as James says, it's about how you learn from them. And I think that is important. That's really important. You know, not necessarily how Spurs react just to this one game, because I'm sure they will do that, but how they are in the future coming off a big win, like the Aston Villa one. You know, can they back that up? Because that is the challenge, and that is what separates teams going for top four, which, as Ange keeps saying, that's not what they're going for. But, you know,
why does he keep saying that? Because I bet you that's what the owner of the club thinks they're doing.
Well, yeah, I think others have made a similar point. I mean, and it's an ongoing thing, and it's going to keep happening because he keeps being asked it, because people don't come to all his press conferences or his interviews. And it's such a well-established thing that at this point of the season, it's all about fourth. And he keeps making the point that it's not. It's about growth, and he's not obsessed with the idea of fourth. The media and him are going to be doing this dance for the rest of the season.
I'm really interested in what you said there, Charlie, because to me, I picked this up 100% wrong, and I'm quite capable of doing that. When he says I'm not interested in fourth, you've interpreted it as I'm interested in the performances. I think he's talking about making a team that's going to win the title.
Well, I think it's both, isn't it? My understanding of that comment when he's made it before was the second thing there, that he was only interested in number one and he's wanted to make the team as good as he possibly could. But I do think, actually, when he said it after this game, and again, Charlie, you're in the room, so correct me if this is wrong, but I think he is saying, as we were kind of alluding to before, he's looking at the longer term development of his team and putting that ahead of results in the immediacy. Is that a fair reading?
Yeah, he's basically saying, what I care about is that at the end of this season, I can look at the team and say, they are moving in the right direction and we are getting closer to a point where we can win the league, because that's the ultimate aim. It's not about fourth or fifth. So his point is, he would rather at the end of the season be able to look at the team and say, they're growing, they're moving in the right direction. Oh, they came fifth. Doesn't matter, because I can see the growth. I can see the direction of travel, than scraping fourth. And he's saying, you know what? We've got a hell of a long way to go. Now, obviously, it's not like one means the other and you can easily have both. But his point is just that his bottom line is not, are we finishing fourth or are we finishing fifth? His bottom line is, are we moving closer to a position where we can go for the title in 1, 2, 3 years, whatever it is?
I suppose the comparison you could make would be, if you look at the end of the 2021-22 season, when Spurs finished above Arsenal, famously, who ultimately was in a better position, Spurs under Antonio Conte or Arsenal under Mikel Arteta? Now, we all know the answer to that question. We don't have to say it. It's fine. But like that is the comparison you can make, right? Like, if you have the right coach and the direction of travel is what it is good, and we would say broadly, silly, it is for Spurs, then in the longer term, like, is this the better way to go?
I understand he's taking the longer term view, but in any business or relationship or life, opportunities present themselves. And this season, the inconsistency of Manchester United and the uselessness of Chelsea and Newcastle United has provided Spurs with perhaps a unique opportunity to qualify for the Champions League, which...
Sorry, I don't agree with that. I think more or less every season, and I have kind of gone back through this, and this isn't kind of copper-bottomed, rock-solid, but more or less every season in the last 10, 12 years, at least one of those big six teams has been shit. Right, and sometimes it's been Spurs. Obviously, last season it was Spurs. But more often than not, there'll be at least one of those teams really, really bad. And if that is the case, and the Premier League gets...
This year there's three of them.
Fine, there you go. All six of those teams will never always be good. And obviously, I appreciate what you're saying, Danny, is it could always be Spurs, which would be bad.
I'm with James on this one, because the numbers bear that out. And every season you hear that same thing of like, oh, you know, United are going to be better next season. Chelsea ain't going anywhere. You know, Newcastle are going to invest. We hear it every year, and yet not everyone gets better and better. The points totals for finishing fourth, I've got them here, are really not great in the last few years. They've gone down. 71, 71, 67, 67, 71. 71 points, you don't need to be a brilliant team to be getting that. And it's been a lot lower than that in a lot of teams. I mean, that's 1.9 points per game.
This is why I get infuriated with talks about projects and processes, because as you rightly point out, things are changing all the time. The idea that you can't pick up on a game like this and get stuck into the team or the manager. And yes, I absolutely, Spurs doing better than I thought they would. I like him as a person. And the football is definitely better to watch than it was for any time in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. But the idea of processes and projects and all the rest of it is based on an intellectual dishonesty that somehow everybody else is going to sit still and let you do your project. They're not. They're working on their project at the same time.
Well, no, but I don't think anyone's saying that. I think we're saying sometimes those projects will fail or other teams will be further behind on those projects.
Even if this is a great opportunity to come fourth, fifth, I think I agree with James that I don't think it's, and I said this a couple of weeks ago, I don't think it's massively different to most years. But anyway, Postecoglou's point, and again, whether you agree with it or not, but I do think that, and again, I mentioned this, that season James talked about there, the 21-22 end of season, and how that was heralded as kind of like the most important race for top four ever, because if you don't get it now, you're screwed. I mean, people were literally saying things. I mean, Gary Neville was saying Arteta should leave Arsenal if he doesn't get fourth, because he'll never have a better opportunity to get fourth. He came second the following season, 24 points ahead of Tottenham.
He didn't finish fourth, though. Gary Neville was right.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, they'll never be able to finish fourth. But, like, so the point is, does getting into the Champions League next season, obviously it is really important financially, we know all that, but I don't think it means you can't then compete at the top level of the Premier League. I mean, Arsenal did it last season, Liverpool are doing it this season. So I can see from Postecoglou's perspective why... You know, and look, he might be bluffing to an extent. Maybe he is obsessing over the Champions League as much as anyone. But I can sort of see his point that it's not the absolute be-all and end-all.
The one thing that I think we can all agree on then, now that it's never going to happen, is it? We talked about the lack of intensity. Who is that down to? The players themselves?
That's hard to say. I mean, obviously, the manager always says the ultimate responsibility lies with him, doesn't he? So I guess you'd have, if we give Postecoglou all the credit for the good performances, you have to say that, though there is an extent to which players have to take some responsibility. I mean, James, have you seen this theory that I don't believe, but this theory that some of the players were kind of saving themselves in the internationals? That feels a little bit conspiratorial to me.
Yeah, I mean, sure. Just because I messaged you on WhatsApp and said, is player X after he throws straight from the game, during the game? In reality,
normally by this time of year, they're accused of being on the beach, aren't they? But so you're not saying that. You're saying they're going somewhere else. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
On the plane.
Just with regards to that intensity thing, in other circumstances, like if a team is struggling for intensity every single week for a whole season, then I think it's fair to say, well, the manager hasn't got this team playing with the right intensity. There must be an issue with your training or his instructions or his relationship with the players or whatever else. But if it flits from high intensity for a good few games, having generally been at that level for most of the season, and then in this one-off game is suddenly really, really low, it seems incredibly unlikely to me that Postecoglou has walked in there and said, actually, you know what, today for this game, just kind of walk around a little. Walk around a little bit. It'll be fine. It's only Fulham.
The only good thing to come out of it, as always, is that you could only lose the 3 points. You could say four because the goal difference turned around again towards Aston Villa's fate, but let's call it 3 points.
And Villa drew as well, so that was, you know, it wasn't a disastrous weekend.
I'll give the listeners another peek. Actually, this is giving you a peek behind the curtain, behind a curtain that you're actually behind, but the message didn't go into the WhatsApp group, so I think this kind of counts. When it looked like West Ham had won that game in injury time, I'd started writing that we should open this podcast with me and you singing I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles, Danny, because of the result on Thursday night and the significance of that potentially for Spurs, and then in the moment what seemed like West Ham having beaten Aston Villa. But obviously...
And by the way, the 5 minutes, 47 seconds to come to that decision, the game...
The game is so gone.
No, but no, that's the cliche. They cannot afford that in a game that sells itself on entertainment. You cannot afford an almost six-minute gap to make a decision that I thought I saw the handball in real time. And I'm watching on a tiny screen, you know. I like that look behind the curtain, which I'm already behind, but maybe not facing the right way at the exact moment, James. Let's take a break.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the Beautiful Lane. Charlie Eccleshare, James Moore, and me, Danny Kelly. And let's go through one or two other things before we return to the wider issue of where Spurs are at the moment. Harry Kane came off in Bayern Munich's runaway win again at the weekend. We saw the draw for the Champions League. Very first name out, of course, was Arsenal. So that was good fun. See who they're going to get. And it's Bayern Munich. I'll ask you, as the Spurs fan here, James, what do we want to happen here in that tie? Because it would suit Spurs if Arsenal won from the coefficient point of view, but it would also put them a step nearer to being champions of Europe. And Harry Kane, no trophy.
Yeah, it's interesting because they've done the semi-final draw as well, and Arsenal or Bayern will play.
Yeah, City,
Manchester City or Real Madrid.
Yeah,
which. Obviously, it's a pretty hard tie over two legs as well.
Basically got the best four teams in one half the draw.
So I'd kind of... I mean, it's a kind of gamble and the kind of statement you can make that you then regret. I just think I'd just rather they just lost to Bayern. But I would prefer Eric Dier to score. That would be good. Eric Dier, winner. The first leg is at the Emirates, isn't it? Which is annoying because you can't get Eric Dier shushing the Emirates with a winner in the last minute of the second leg, but whatever.
We should talk a little bit, well, just mention that on this question of plastic fans, I thought Postecoglou, you know, whatever else about him, he does give you, and I'm sure you appreciate it, you two in particular, he does give you considered answers to questions that other managers would swerve hugely. Remember, the exact quote was talking about plastic fans because of, you know, the season ticket prices thing, and then people were complaining bitterly that it's hard to get them because of so many overseas fans come to the game. And, you know, I've already stated on here that I suspect the long-term plan for the big football clubs is to lessen the influence of season ticket holders.
See, that's really harsh, yeah? Because I'll tell you why. Because I'm probably plastic and touristy, because I was coming from the other side of the world, really passionate about football. And if I could get access to see a Premier League game, that was the world to me. So to label people plastic or tourists, I don't think that's fair. Just because people live on the other side of the world. This football club has supporters all over the world, have supporters all over the UK that don't always get access to the games of people who live here. And I think we should always have the ability to accommodate them and give them that feeling of, you know, it doesn't make them any less passionate. I think it's really disrespectful to call fans who are willing to go to the expense of coming halfway around the world. You don't know how passionate they are about their football club. Maybe they've only started supporting it in the last 2 years. Who knows? I don't know. But that doesn't diminish who they are, I don't think.
I thought it's such a hot potato at the moment that he could probably have not said anything more sensible than that. I thought it was terrific.
It was really good. And in the moment when he was asked it, I did think, oh, he's going to... Like, that's a really good question, because he's not going to take kindly to the idea of plastic or tourist fans. And yeah, it was a really good response. And, you know, because he'd been asked the previous week about the ticket hike, and then he was asked about it again. And I was thinking, you know, there's not loads more he can say. But then this was a really interesting angle. And it was one of those things that I thought after the press conference, because in the room, I was like, that was really interesting. And he spoke about it in a really impassioned way. It was really forceful the way he made the point. And I thought, I wonder if that will translate as well when written down. I'm glad it has. And I'm glad it's got people talking, because I think it is a really interesting talking point. And it's something that at the Fulham game, we were all discussing. And I think that has resonated with a lot of people who feel that they are kind of unfairly brandished in that way.
One or two of your questions here. Joe Green asks, this is for you specifically, Charlie. It's a laser-pointed question, a bit like plasticky. How many games does Charlie predict Spurs can afford to lose and still get fourth spot? I know you're not obsessing about fourth. I know it's a long-term zoom-out situation and all of that.
Oh, no, I am. It's just the manager isn't. Yeah, I've looked at the numbers this morning off the back of this question. So I think if Spurs got 18 points, that would take them to 71, which has been good enough in each of the previous four seasons. And that would mean they're on 53 now. So that they could, in theory, then they've got 10 games to go. They could win six and lose four and still get 71 and just about get fourth. I mean, I've looked at Villa. So Villa are on 56, and that would mean them getting 14 points, let's say, to take them to 70. And I think there's every possibility they won't rack up a huge tally. They've got hard games, really. They've got Wolves at home, City away, Brentford home, Arsenal away, Bournemouth and Chelsea at home, Brighton away, Liverpool at home, Palace away. So and they're still in the Conference League, and you'd expect would probably get through that quarterfinal. So yeah, I think there's a world in which that's if Spurs won those six games, that they could lose four and still get the top four.
Let's not make assumptions about which games they'll win on the basis of what happened on Saturday. Not that we were saying that was an easy game, but Luton at home, Forest at home, Burnley at home, Sheffield United away, Charlie's beloved Sheffield United. That's four.
Tough place to go, fans.
Tough place to go on the last day of the season when they've been relegated about 6 weeks ago. And then the rest of it, though, is West Ham and Chelsea away, Newcastle away, Man City, Arsenal at home, Liverpool away. I mean, if you're looking at winning two of those games,
they can do that, surely.
International break now. It comes, of course, I suspect this is a very bad time for the international break to come for Spurs. You don't want to be having your worst performance of the season and then 2 weeks to dwell on it. Or are they going to be able to go away and forget about that then and get on with playing for their countries? And I guess, is there anything we should be looking out for in this international break with Spurs? I suppose the usual thing, James, is make sure all the players come back fit.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, I would say it's probably a good time for the international break if we think Van de Ven is the most important player in the team or the player that they can afford to be without the least. If those 2 weeks make the difference in terms of him being back for the next game, even though...
Do we have any feeling about this, Chaz? Sorry, no one calls you Chaz.
Quite a few people do, actually.
Charlie Baby. Can I call you Charlie Baby?
Call me whatever you want.
Okay, good.
What's that Monty Python sketch? The Eddie Baby.
Can I
call you Eddie? Everybody calls me Ted. The sense is that the hope is that he'll be back soon after the international break. Whether that actually means Luton, obviously that's the first game back, that would be ideal. But yeah, the sense is it won't be long after that either way. Their record with and without him is really striking. And I know the stats heads will tell you to be very careful about points per game with and without players, but none of them are here, so we can do it. When he starts, they average 2.2 points per game, and that includes this Chelsea game where he limped off before half time. Without him, 1.3 points per game. That 1.3 points per game is pretty bad, and that's from 9 games. And I know that in some of those they were missing lots of other players, but clearly they do really struggle. They've only lost twice with him starting. One was that Chelsea one.
Will Ray was among those who asked us about Van der Ven and his importance. And Will, I forgot to mention your name, but I hope that us begging him to come back as soon as the international over, I hope that answers your question of his importance to the team. Though you're right, Charlie, worrying about one player, you know, coaches have, teams have the ability to cover for one player if they make certain tweaks. And Dragosin, you could tear his performance apart, but it was his first full game. And I thought that actually what I thought was not the defending. I thought it was the necessity of playing most of the ball with his right foot in that position. And you could almost argue, and I'm not arguing this, but I'm saying you could almost argue that Ben Davis, because he's left-footed, gives that slot between himself and Udogi a different dimension.
I do think as well, Danny, that does sort of encapsulate where Spurs are, that they're not yet really in a position where they can absorb losing key players to injury, certainly not multiple ones. And I know this was only one, but you know, that's the difference between, you know, we've said it, Postecoglou's got a squad, got a team, and he's got a few players probably trust outside of it, but he doesn't have a squad that he trusts and really believes in the same way that, you know, a Liverpool or a City have that. You know, De Bruyne can be out for half the season and they somehow are fine. It's different levels. But on their day, I think Spurs could beat City. You know, that's where they are.
Okay, unless anybody else has got anything else to add, I'm doing any other business now since we're doing it like Parliament. Thank you very much indeed. I'm taking a deep breath because I'm not going to lie, I was pretty put out by that performance at Fulham. But I don't want to blame any individual at this stage, but I do reserve the right to talk about it openly and not pretend that in so doing you're somehow deflating the tyres of the project. We talk about the games as we see them. That's what we're here for. Thank you, James, for doing just that. And thank you, Charlie, for doing just that. And thank you all for listening. And just to remind you, the show has its own official home on Twitter at VFTL Podcast. You can email us as well at VFTL@theathletic.com for the best Spurs coverage anywhere from Charlie, Jack, and so many other brilliant writers, analysts, and all the rest of it. And sometimes people make wonderful diagrams. Make sure you just sign up to The Athletic. We're not going to come back in the middle of this week. What's the point of talking about Joe Rodon's performance for Wales? Thank you for listening to The View from the Lane. Cheers for now.
The Athletic.